general government order. What a godlike act, bringing order out of chaos. There's something scriptural about that somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to open with a short hearing on Senate Bill 402, just to allow the illustrious and always precise and concise Senator Ben Westland to make testimony. And then we will adjourn that little hearing because we are stuck waiting for amendments that did not make it from council the way they should have. Okay? But we'll listen, as always, to your words of wisdom, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27. I very much appreciate the characterization of you bringing order to the chaos I bring to this front.
Oh, I didn't say you brought it. But
well, I'm a sensitive, you know, kind of guy.
But anyway, if you want to take the blame, we'll let you.
Yeah. I'm just here to testify certainly on behalf of Senate Bill 402. I believe there is quite a good deal of merit in the bill, in its intent and spirit, and while saying that, at the same time, fully anticipate that the amendments coming from Harrison in LC will make this noble bill an implementable and practical bill. So that's a long way of saying, Mr. Chair, this bill needs a little help, but we need to work on it. I'd be happy to take any questions.
We don't have any questions, I don't think, on your bill. It's ready to go, except for the amendments, which, as I understand it, just help the counties to charge whoever they need to charge for.
Yeah, there needs to be an appropriate covering of costs.
Right. And that's all we need.
Yeah.
Okay.
Happy to help. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, sir. Are there, Senator Verger, do you have any questions?
No, I do have an amendment with me. Is there another amendment coming?
Correct.
Okay.
Right. Okay. It's the amendment that's coming replace that amendment?
Correct.
So that's right. An obsolete amendment.
We are approaching the chaos level again, Mr. Chair.
Through no fault of our own, I'd like to suggest.
It's life.
Thank you very much for showing your interest. It will be noted. I'm going to close a hearing on Senate Bill 402. I realize we're still in a subcommittee, but I hope that Judith can remedy that by the time we get all the way through Senate Bill 856, because I'd like to pass this one out. So if you would make some calls to folks.
Sure, I will.
Would you give us a background on Senate Bill 856 real quick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 856 modifies the qualifications and terms of members of the Commission on Asian Affairs. It also modifies duties of that commission. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Carol Suzuki is going to speak on this bill, and we'll let her do that, and now we even have a quorum to deal with it. So thank you, Carol, for coming.
Thank you very much. Chairman Shields and members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to address you today regarding Senate Bill 856. For the record, my name is Carol Suzuki. I reside...
Carol, would you mind if I ask Carol to move the microphone a little bit?
Yeah, move the microphone a little close, either that or get us to quiet down up here.
Okay. Observing the sign.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. For the record, my name is Carol Suzuki. I reside in Salem, Oregon, and have served as a member of the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs since my appointment in 2001. I was elected chair in 2003. I am a citizen volunteer, and I donate all of my time to the commission. The Commission on Asian Affairs is the youngest of the four state advocacy commissions, having been created during the 1995 legislative session. As a commission, we serve as a resource to the governor and state legislators and assist government agencies in their outreach efforts to Asian Americans, and we also act as a facilitator to connect people to government services. Senate Bill 856 brings the statutes governing the Oregon Commission on Asian Affairs into alignment with its sister commissions, the Commissions on Black Affairs, Hispanic Affairs, and the Commission for Women. It also removes redundant or unnecessary language in the current statutes. The changes to the commission statutes have no fiscal impact, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Are there any questions on Senate Bill 856? If there are no questions, could I have, let's see, we are just in public hearing. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 856.
Mr. Chairman, I recommend that we move Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 856 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? If there is none, so ordered. And do I have to arm wrestle Senator Brown to carry this, or...
I'm not sure.
Well, the two of us will settle it later, okay? Probably that means Senator Brown will carry the bill since she was the sponsor and since I would never cross my majority leader. Okay?
All right.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad to let her go back upstairs because at very least, the third floor would have to shut down if she was gone another 5 minutes. Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Okay, now what are we doing?
67.
We want to go to 67, Senate Bill 67. Do we have a list? Yep. As the list comes forward, I'll ask that Judith read the background on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Senate Bill 67 changes the annual matching fund grant program for museums to a biennial competitive grant program. We have now the Dash 1 amendments that add a purpose statement. You have those amendments at your seat at the dais. The purpose as stated in the amendment says the purpose of this section is to direct the Oregon Heritage Commission to assist in projects for the collection and management of heritage collections and for heritage-related tourism and to assist in projects related to the heritage aspects of education and interpretation. We have a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Unless I'm getting a little bit senile, which is quite possible, I think it was Senator Starr who had some question about the whole issue. Am I not correct, Senator Starr, the whole issue of the purpose statement?
Yep.
And so we have some folks who come to talk about that. From the Oregon Museums Association, Catherine Hunt, I think it is, and Irene. All right, shall I kill this word or just ask Irene to come forward? Come on forward. Thank you for agreeing to come and talk with us. We did have some questions when we heard this bill. We just wanted to kind of clarify a little bit.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Irene Zenev.
Zenev.
Zenev, yes. And
thank you.
I am the president of the Oregon Museums Association. I am also an exhibits curator at the Benton County Historical Museum in Philomath.
They did kind of throw me off my horse when they referred to the fact that the president of the OMA was here, and I kept wondering what this had to do with medical doctors.
Exactly.
But I caught up with you after a while.
Well, our OMA is a nonprofit organization which serves the educational needs of the Oregon museum community, and we've been doing that since 1978. OMA meets three times a year in different parts of the state, presenting programs that address the concerns of museum professionals, board members, and volunteers. We currently have over 200 institutional, individual, and corporate members and serve as an advocate for our membership. OMA members appreciate the legislature's long-standing support of Oregon museums through the museum grant program. OMA has actively taken part in the program through solicitation of applications and appointing representatives of the museum community to participate in the grant review process. Oregon museums take many forms. Some are large, professionally staffed museums, while others are small, volunteer-operated organizations, and many are somewhere in between. All museums of any size seek funding from a number of sources in order to do their work of preserving collections in perpetuity, mounting exhibitions, educating the public about their collections, while engaging students, teachers, researchers, tourists, and members of the community. Museums support themselves through different combinations of private donations, foundation and grant funding, and sometimes government funding, including the museum grant. In the past, the museum grant program has benefited all qualified museums applying for funds for operational support. In the case of some very small institutions, these grants are the only public funds the museum may have received. In recent years, the large number of applicants has resulted in individual grants of only about $200 to $300 per institution. In very small institutions, this amount of funding is significant. To larger institutions, the amount was not. In addition, some perceive this method of granting funds as entitlement in nature and expressed a desire to change a system that was considered to be outdated. In 2002, Oregon Museums Association met with the representatives of the Oregon Historical Society and the Oregon Heritage Commission to re-examine the grant program. Re-examination of the process by policymakers resulted in proposed changes to the system. These changes are incorporated into Senate Bill 67, essentially transforming the program into a competitive grant system with fewer but larger dollar amount awards to grantees. Oregon Museums Association supports these changes because larger awards will be more attractive to small heritage museums, which are prevalent in the state. There will be a measurable effect on museum programs through grant reporting mechanisms and feedback. And many museums may be able to undertake more significant projects if other funders are stimulated to help underwrite projects with matching funds. The Oregon Museums Association will do its best to promote the renewed grant program approved by the Senate. We will continue to serve as peer reviewers and consultants to the process. And thank you so much for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have any comments real quickly on the Dash One Amendment?
We're in favor of the amendment.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Senator George saw your hand first, and then Senator Verger.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. In this Dash One Amendment, it talks about heritage-related tourism. Are you folks interacting right now with that new amount of money that flows into tourism promotion? Because I've always thought that was an attraction. If you were going to go to a community on the coast, for example, and you had something included in information available from tourism, is that kind of what you're thinking about with that use of that language in line four, or something else?
Well, Mr. Chair and Senator George, heritage-related tourism is always at the top of every museum's agenda these days. One of the things that Oregon Museums Association does is publish a brochure and guide to all museums in the state and distributes it free. So we are always promoting heritage-related tourism and see it as an integral part of our business.
Quick follow-up.
Senator George.
Is that associated with the statewide tourism effort so that they have that available in order to hand out to as a packet of an interested person inquiring about Oregon?
Mr. Chair and Senator George, we distribute those brochures through all the welcome centers, so chambers of commerce, those kind of places. So although we work in concert with heritage tourism, we see them as a partner in our purpose. And
Thanks,
Amelia.
Thank you.
Senator Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You have no public funds in your grant program, your application. The funds are all part of the nonprofit, but not public funds?
Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, public funds
as in taxpayer funds. Taxpayer.
I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, James Hamrick, Parks and Rec. This is SB 67 is our bill. Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, the museum grant aid program is funded with currently with Parks and Recreation Fund, Parks and Natural Resource Fund monies, which are lottery funds that go to the Parks and Recreation Department.
Okay. So, follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So, do you have an appeals process?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, an appeals process relating to someone who's been turned down from a grant? Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, I think that the administrative rules for the program, I think, do not currently have any sort of contested case rules for them. The committee that reviews the grants, there are criteria that have to be met. And if and this big committee decides whether or not they've met the criteria, and it, and to date, if they had met the criteria, they are automatically entitled to the monies. So, for instance, if part of the criteria of the application was that they needed to provide a financial statement, and they didn't do that, and some of them don't, then they are disqualified automatically.
I see. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions? I want to thank you. Nobody here has any problem with dash ones, right? And we're done with our discussion. Is that correct? In that case, I would like to close the hearing on Senate Bill 67 and open a work session on Senate Bill 67.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 67.
Senator George has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 67. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator George.
At this time, I'd like to recommend that the committee move Senate Bill 67 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 67 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question. And I don't know the answer, so
okay.
The question is, since there are funds coming through Parks and Rec and lottery funds, would there be an appeals process required?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Senator Berger, basically everything that basically every decision that we make on just about anything is appealable. And I just can't tell you at this time whether there's a formal appeal process. And perhaps is there a particular situation that you're referring to? Or
no, just in general, a person that would be turned down for a grant. I mean, surely you can't fund every applicant.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berger, we basically, with this program that we're going to turn into a competitive grant program, is quite likely that we will not be able to fund every single grant the way we are now.
Right.
And I suspect that when if this bill passes, that we will change our administrative rules to, in fact, set up an appeals process if it doesn't already exist in the rules.
All right. Thank you.
Are you satisfied? I guess, is there any other discussion? I guess I'll call for a vote on this this bill, on Senate Bill 67. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye. The Senate Bill 67 passes. Is there somebody who would like to carry this? Senator George says he would like to carry this bill, and so he shall. I'm going to move down the page as quickly as I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Thank you for clarifying things for us today. I'm moving down the page as quickly as I can. Senate Bill 367. There is a dash one amendment, and we've already had, excuse me, what did I say, 361? Yeah.
367.
How'd I do that?
You got the first bill and second bill mixed up.
You know, my first hearing this morning was at 7 a.m. Maybe that's what's affecting me. 316. Okay, now, we've already had a hearing on this bill, have we not? We already had a hearing. The only thing that I want to do is a quick hearing on the dash ones, and then I want to move it. I've had one person raise a question on this bill, and I don't want to spend much time on it. Is that clear? Sandra, if you come up and spend more than a minute and a half, I'll cut you off. Okay? So I'm going to open the hearing. I don't see that this has anything to do with the Fair Competition Alliance, but I'll allow you to speak briefly.
They've got your letter.
I'm going to ask Judith to make a comment, and I'm going to ask her a question before you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Senate Bill 316 is the measure that requires state agencies to notify the advocate for minority, women, and emerging small businesses to notify that advocate of an award of a public contract with a value of $5,000 or more. It directs the Department of Administrative Services to adopt rules in consultation with the advocate to establish a process and timeline for providing the notice and information required. It applies to solicitation for bids and contract awards made on or after the effective date. You have before you the dash one amendments. Those amendments delete submission through the Department of Administrative Services and instead requires each agency to adopt rules to establish the process and timelines for notifying the advocate. And we have a no revenue and no fiscal impact statement issued on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Sandra, go ahead.
Thanks, sir. Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify this afternoon. I have it in writing, so I'll let that stand. But just for the record, my name is Sandra Bishop, representing the Fair Competition Alliance. This is a nonprofit business association with both business and union members. What we're concerned about with this bill is that you do not exclude a large number of contracts that go directly to nonprofits without competitive bid through the QRF process. Those contracts are estimated at a value of anywhere from $35 million to $60 million a year, and we have reason to believe that there has been in the past no effort to get any sort of database together. So this is one of the first opportunities to actually capture that data along with other contracts. So please do not exclude those contracts in this data reporting system. That is the reason for the question, and we'd like clarification whenever possible on whether or not those set aside non-competitive contracts are going to be included in this database. And that is all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. In my committee, I have a new rule, fly or die.
I'm digging that rule, Mr. Chair.
Either we fly through these or your bill dies. Okay? Yes.
I just have one. I'm sorry. Taken care of. Sorry.
Okay.
I read the second line of the A amendment. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any questions, any more discussion of Senate Bill 316?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't want to slow the process down.
Not a problem.
It's been determined that there's no fiscal on this, and yet we're going to have each agency to go through a rulemaking process in consultation with the advocate to establish, you know, this new deal.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. Senator Starr. We had the no fiscal, no revenue on the original bill. With the dash one amendments, the typical impact is going to be $5,000 for each agency having to go through an administrative rule process. So I would expect before we drop the bill, we would have a fiscal impact showing the $5,000 to each agency for administrative rule promulgation.
And so my question, Mr. Chair, is how many agencies times 5,000 do we, you know, it doesn't take but 11 and we pass the $50,000 mark?
Very good question, Senator Starr. Because it does say each agency, so that would apply to every single agency that lets public contracts.
Realistically, how many do?
I would have to get legislative fiscal down here to answer that.
I was thinking that doesn't DAS handle the vast majority of them for other agencies?
The amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, but the amendment does take DAS out of the process and requires the promulgation by each agency.
So we created a bigger mess than we started with?
We created more of a fiscal impact by not sending everything through DAS.
Mr. Chair?
Yes?
Could I ask, do we know if these amendments have been run by the proponents of the bill?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
They have?
Yes.
And they agreed to them?
That's correct.
And they didn't, but they didn't know, they didn't anticipate a very good question by Senator Starr. Right? Am I correct?
That's right. Senator Gordley and Lydia Muniz, who is the current advocate, have reviewed the amendments and agreed to those.
Mr. Chair, could we? I mean, if it's a good bill, you know, we could adopt the amendment, send it to Ways and Means, and then they can incorporate it into that budget, and they can move it forward.
We are. At least I have been loath to send things to Ways and Means, which seems to be the burial ground for lots of great ideas.
And, Mr. Chair, I would comment that, if I might, that I'm not sure Senator Gordley would agree to the amendment if she knows that this bill is doomed to die down in Ways and Means because the fiscal's too huge.
I might want to close the work session for now and we could get it resolved. Perhaps
I'm going to close the work session for the moment. How do we go about that?
I will.
You're going to race around for a while?
Run down to fiscal, yes, sir.
She's going to run down to fiscal and try and figure out something. She's going to get us started. We're done with 402 for the day, so you're going to get us started on 563?
Correct.
Great. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 563 provides that water utilities may not refuse to supply water to the owner or an occupant of the premises solely because the former owner or occupant of the premises failed to pay for water supply. It does punish that by a maximum fine of $720. We have a no revenue impact statement on the measure. We do not have word from fiscal on this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are we waiting for an amendment on this one, too? Still waiting? Forever waiting? I'm looking
Mr.
at
Mr. Chair, members, the reason for that note, and it's my understanding that the cities want to see whether or not, Mr. Chair, you're willing to move forward on the bill before requesting amendments. The cities, as my understanding, are opposed to the concept in general. And if you would like to move forward, they would like an amendment such that current occupants can't simply change the name on the lease and thereby duck their water bills.
Okay. That was an interesting scenario. Who developed that with me the other day? Somebody was...
Susan Schneider.
Yeah.
Who's not in the room, but Mr. Pope is here.
Okay. I'll let you run and do your thing, and we'll have John come forward. But you already have a question before he says anything.
I have a question of just the wording. It says punishes by maximum of $720. Fine. I'm not sure whether they're punishing the person that's moved in or the person that escaped without paying the bill. It doesn't say.
Well, maybe you can elucidate us on that subject, too, can you?
I'll try, Chair.
Okay.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today concerning this bill. For the record, I am John Papanuk. I'm a supervisor with the City of Portland on the Bureau of Utilities Customer Services. We deal with customer service issues for water, for the water bills there. I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before your committee today on the potential impacts of this legislation. The City of Portland is opposed to Senate Bill 563 as it is written. Presently, the city spends a significant amount of time, amount of resources and attempts on determining who the prior occupant truly is, as well as to determine whether the new occupant has a relationship to previous occupants. We have found that common relationships are roommates, a spouse or a partner, or another relative or a friend. Unfortunately, we find that some customers will attempt to move out or move the account responsibilities from one individual to another in attempts to avoid paying for water services. We have determined that all too frequently the new occupant is actually an individual who has previously resided at the residence and was not listed as an occupant responsible for the water bill. Presently, when this determination is made, the utility may refuse new service when an unpaid balance exists for the previous occupant.
Are there occasions when the previous occupant may actually still be an occupant? They've just moved the bill to another person?
Chair Shields, that's correct. That happens frequently.
But you don't know that that other occupant is still there because he's not listed anymore or she's not listed anymore or whatever. And so supposedly the phantom that ran off and didn't pay the bills may still actually be living in the residence.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. We make every effort to try and determine that when we believe that there might be something suspicious that's going on there.
Okay. Continue.
In other situations, we find that there has been no effort made by either the occupant or the owner to notify the utility of any changes in occupancy or billing responsibility. We believe that the owner has an obligation to notify the utility of any occupancy or responsibility changes, and failing to do so should obligate the owner for resulting billings for water services provided. Also, where the property is vacant, the owner should be responsible for any water services that have been provided during that vacancy. As such, these charges should be paid prior to the establishment of services for any new occupant. We are not clear about the problem this bill is designed to solve that is not already covered by current statute. We would be interested in learning more about the problem that prompted this bill and working with the committee to find a solution. I'm willing to take questions.
Other questions for John? Go ahead.
Well, I presume that when the bill has not been paid, you have a little thing that you put on the doorknob and you turn the water off. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vogger, that is correct. We go through pretty...
There's a process.
Yeah.
And
yes.
You have somebody that goes out there and then they cut the water off. Then there's no moving out and you're not notified of anything, and then a new customer wants to move in and the water's cut off and they go down to the city hall and try to get it cut back on, and you say you have to pay $800, $500, whatever it's owed. Is that the
Chair,
process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Barger.
Berger,
I'm sorry.
In
reality, most customers do exactly what everyone would expect them to do. Most customers will call us up and say that they are either moving into a premises or moving out of a premises and that they no longer wish to be responsible or that they wish to be responsible. Many landlords will call in and let us know that they have a tenancy change, that somebody has moved in and moved out. Where we see problems with this particular bill is in a significant number, not the majority, but a significant number of customers where that is not the case, where people find themselves in problems in paying the bill, the water bill, and then the water will be shut off. And in order to restore service, many people in those circumstances will attempt to have a roommate then establish the service in their name, trying to put forth the attitude that there's a new tenant that's in there, mm-hmm. when in fact that was someone that was living there all along. And it goes on. It could be maybe it was in the husband's name, and so now the wife calls up to say that she's moving in, and it's just in her name, and they might have separate, different names.
Right.
Any number, it seems to be endless, the stories that come up. I don't want it to sound like every single human being does this, because
No.
They don't do this.
No.
Most customers do exactly what we would expect them to do, but it's this smaller portion of our population that drives the costs up tremendously. We spend maybe a third of all of our time dealing with some of these issues, and it's a small, relatively speaking, it's a small number. We're not for profit, and so whenever we have debt that is not paid, that actually gets rolled back into the rates for
other customers who get to pay that in the future. Most other customers don't appreciate that.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
All right, I'm an apartment owner, and I own an apartment, and Harry James lives in the apartment, and he moves out owing a bill. I go in, get the apartment ready, and rent it to a new person. They can't get the water turned on because Harry James owed a bill. So in that case, the owner of the apartment building would have to pay the debt and worry about collecting from Harry James so that I could have water. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, every district, water district, has their own sets of rules. I can only speak for the city of Portland and where we are today.
Okay.
In that situation today, if we were confident that there was a totally new tenant that was moving into the premises, then we would restore service for that new tenant, even if there was an outstanding bill.
Even if there was an outstanding bill.
That is as of today. That's correct.
Huh.
Senator George, you had a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. When you look at Section 2 of the bill, it talks about the idea that the water utility, because water is so critical for everything that happens inside of that apartment, may not make a determination not to supply solely because the former owner refused to pay the bill. And it really focuses on that idea of the former owner or occupant. It seems to me, because it is so critical for the very life and well-being of that individual that might be occupying that new apartment, if they have water, it appears to me that a statement like this, being in law, provides protection for the new occupant, still because you can have put all other qualifications on there. It says you can't do this solely because of the lack of payment. So you can put qualifications on there. What's wrong with this being in law, indicating that the legislature believes there needs to be a legitimate reason not to supply water to a new tenant?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, we believe where this comes up is usually single-family rentals. It's primarily where it comes up. If it's going from owner to owner, we don't experience this type of situation or problem too much in that. And multifamily in the city of Portland, that is the responsibility of the owner anyway, if it's a multifamily property. But if it's a single-family residence that's being rented out, that's where we have some of the concerns. What we see on some of our customers' accounts is that certain properties have a history of people moving in and out, and there never being a bill paid on that. We feel that the owners in those situations are essentially running a small business, in some cases a large business, because they have many properties throughout the city that this happens on. And we feel that it's an unfair burden on the rest of the ratepayers within the city to subsidize, essentially, the costs associated with that type of activity. We actually have discussed it in length, and we feel that in some of those situations that it should be the responsibility of the owner to pay that. And if a tenant moved out of the property, then before that property could be rented again or leased to a new tenant, the owner would pay for that bill, and then it would be turned back on, and it would be a rentable property at that point in time. It's a lot like the thing I hear from my customers who call me about this is it's a lot like garbage, where garbage is the responsibility of the owner, and the owner has to pay that. And I'm not sure if it's exactly the same as that, but we wouldn't be cutting the water off for a new tenant. What we propose is that you would not provide service. The service would already be disconnected for that customer, for that residence, and we wouldn't provide it until that bill had been taken care of.
I just had my staff call Senator Beyer, since he's a sponsor of the bill. You made the statement earlier, and certainly governmental affairs people for the city of Portland that are around this building should have noticed that this bill was Senator Beyer's bill. And yet in your testimony, you just indicated that you didn't know whose bill this, well, you didn't say you didn't know whose bill this was, but you didn't know what problem generated the need for this bill to come forward. So at that point in time, I thought I would ask Senator Beyer if he would come down and explain the reason why the bill came forward for you from the city of Portland. Okay. And if you could do that, Senator Beyer, just come up. And I want to resolve this because this bill seems to have a good purpose, as Senator George was pointing out. And yet you have a serious problem. Senator Beyer, what they were saying is that sometimes in the city of Portland, you'll have two or three people living in an apartment. And supposedly, one will move out, and the bill becomes somebody else's responsibility. But in fact, that person may not have even moved out, or maybe they moved out and moved back in, having not paid the water bill, and the new person in the apartment doesn't admit that the old person is still there, and it just becomes kind of a con to keep from paying the water bill. You know, you can play a game. So I'm just trying to resolve this little issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9, here to testify in Senate Bill 563, which a bill I introduced and as a request of a constituent. And I apologize, I didn't catch most of the testimony that was just previous to this, but the nexus of this bill, and I'm going from a memory because this issue was brought to me about August or September of 2003. So, and if you remember where we were in August and September of 2003, we were right at the end of a legislative session. And
it's a wonder you have any brain cells left in August of 2003.
But it was a constituent from the Colton area, Colton community out in rural Clackamas County, where they operate a water utility. And the person had an issue because they were trying to get into a house and the utility would not turn the water on because the previous tenant of the house had not paid the final bill. And that was a nexus for this bill. We had the bill drafted, we introduced the bill, and since that time the person who had the problem has not come forward to come and support them. Apparently they've solved the problem in the year and a half since the bill was drafted. And so I don't have the history as to what happened in the Colton Utility District, or Water District. The bill still seems to make some sense because we have an issue, and to the City of Portland's defense, which is you all know that I don't say those words very often, but Willie Tiffany from the League of Oregon Cities did talk to me about this bill and say that the City of Portland may have some issues with the bill. But he also said that there's a difference between a water utility and a city-run water system or whatever Portland is. Mm-hmm. So the bill may not even apply to the City of Portland because it may be different in statute. I don't know that the specifics of that. Mr. Chair, I know I have not been a whole lot of help on this bill. I'd be happy to work with whoever wants to work with me on the issue, because I do think the bill has merit, and it was an issue that was raised by a constituent, even though that constituent seems to have his problems solved and is no longer, you know, volunteering to come forward. So I'd be happy to answer any questions if I could.
Okay. I have a question for John in front of you here. Can you see the point of the bill? I mean, now that Senator Byers talked about what happened out in his jurisdiction,
Mr. Chair, the Portland Water Bureau has does have an appeal process in place. That one is that you talk to the representative that's there on the telephone. That's how we move people in and out. Virtually all is by the telephone that we do that. If an unsatisfactory result comes from that, you can talk to one of my leads. If an unsatisfactory result comes from that, you can talk to myself, or we have formed what we call an advanced solutions team, which looks at unusual circumstances and tries to deal with those circumstances. Typically, those will be referred to us, perhaps from the mayor's office or commissioners. And if that team has not resolved the situation to the satisfactory of the customer, then they can go to an administrative review committee, which is the committee is formed by members from the Water Bureau, the Sewer Bureau, from from the mayor's office, and those people will listen to, will read testimony from the customer as to what the situation is and make a determination at that point. The whole process is costly in these situations, and again, I believe that it goes back, this is my belief, is it goes back to the fact that the landlord has a small business that's there, and we feel that in certain cases that landlord should be paying for unpaid bills, because we see abuse in those areas there, and that those bills should be paid before another tenant occupies a residence without water service at it.
Well, so you want to put the onus on the landlord to make sure that that bill is paid before people move out. Now, you've just created a scenario not too much dissimilar to what Senator Beyer just talked about. He was talking about a tenant goes to move into a new place. That tenant has no relationship, no knowledge of the previous tenant. They get in there, they can't get the water turned on. What's fair about that? What is fair about that?
Chair, I think you just hit the nail on the head is what the issue is, because many times when this happens, the tenant moves in, he or she has just come up with a first and a last month rent and probably some kind of security deposit or an apartment to even get to the point where they can walk in, get a set of keys, and try to take a shower. And nothing comes out of the tap.
And I guess the difference between Colton and the city of Portland, you rattled off a system that probably has more participants than they have in the city of Colton. You know, there's got to be, talk about urban-rural divide, some way of making this system work for everybody's benefit. I mean, are you just wanting to stick the landlord in the middle? I mean, maybe, I don't know how the landlord would go about keeping track of everybody and making sure that, I mean, what does a landlord do if somebody moves out? They move out. He can't stand there with a gun and stop them from moving out until after they pay their water bill.
Mr. Chair, typically what we do is if we, again, I would like to say that most customers do what we expect them to do.
Right. This is a few bad apples.
Yeah, which causes a lot of headaches, quite frankly. But what we would like to see is what we do typically is when we believe that a situation like this has occurred, one of the resources that we do is we call the landlord. And we try and verify through that landlord who is actually living there and whether this individual who has supposedly left is still living there. We'll even ask for copies of lease agreements to see who is actually living there. Again, at the present time, if we find that it is a totally separate entity that is moving into the property, water will be restored for that individual that's moving in there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I want to get back to this public safety issue because you have a young family or maybe a single mom with two or three children who's moving into this apartment. She has absolute needs for water. I mean, that is the very basis of all life, is that water issue. And health and cleanliness of those children is critical. I mean, she could be looking at a situation in which she could lose her control of those children to service the children and family if, in fact, she couldn't do this. What kind of time period are we talking about before you could guarantee, without a statement like this, if you don't have a statement that says, you know, there's points of innocence here, and that's a new occupant that comes in, how long before the water's on? Guaranteed.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you know, once we've determined that the occupancy is different, it is the same day.
But how long is that period before you make that determination?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, Typically, that determination is made also the same day. We can usually make it within hours, as long as people are giving us the information that we're asking for. And virtually all of the times, that is over the telephone. People don't need to come down and talk to us. We can get that information over the phone and then verify some of that information and make those decisions.
Bluntly, I'm inclined to be favorably disposed toward this bill. I don't like to run over the city. I don't want to make life more difficult for you. There is testimony that's just been put on your desk by Willie Tiffany from the League of Oregon Cities, which says they're opposed to the bill, too. I don't want to run over all the cities in the state, okay, if indeed they're represented that way. But there's still this huge issue. And Senator Beyer tried to address it.
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
I've got a committee next door, and I've got constituents in my office. So, I'd love to be able to work with, you know, Judith, if someone in the cities, if we need to work something out.
All right.
You keep me informed.
If you're okay with that, we're going to request the League of Cities in Portland get with you and Judith and work out whatever needs to be worked out. Otherwise, I'd like to see us go ahead with something. So the onus is on you guys to work out an amendment that makes sense.
Okay.
All right?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, I'll thank you for coming, Senator Beyer. I appreciate your time. I'll close the hearing on 563. Thank you very much. And Judith, do you have something to tell us about Senate Bill 316?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
This is a hearing, I guess, or is it a work session, or what is it on 316 that we're in?
Go ahead. Legislative Fiscal confirms that they would like some time to estimate the cost of the administrative rules process because not all agencies, for example, the $5,000 for administrative rulemaking, they may already be promulgating rules, and therefore they would not have an additional $5,000 impact. So some state agencies that are already anticipating administrative rule promulgation would not have the $5,000 full impact. Also, they would have to consider which of the 120 agencies let public contracts for $5,000 or more in order to do an accurate estimate.
You didn't have time to talk to Senator Gordley about this, did you? I don't imagine
no,
you did. Thank you for that insightful question, Senator Starr. That's a very good question. I suppose that means that we just have to close this hearing on 316 and find out what the heck's going on. Does that make sense?
We'll get a fiscal estimate.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
120 times 5,000 is only $600,000. So.
Yeah, and you know you could do a whole lot of minority contracts for that amount of money. Please explain this to Senator Gordley.
I will.
Will you?
And we'll
and
see then if she wants the amendments.
Find out what in the world is going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to close the hearing on 316. After having that one shot down, and we've done 563, that gets us to, where are we, 577?
That's correct.
Okay.
76.
And it's the dash 2 amendments, not the dash 1 amendments that we're talking about now. So we've got a public hearing on 577. Go ahead, give us the poop on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 577 allows state library assessment of agencies to be based on the use of the library by the agency in addition to strictly the number of agency employees, which is how they calculate assessments at this time. It would declare an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. We have now received the dash 2 amendments that applies the assessment based on use to the state library only, and in fact allows the Oregon Law Library to make an assessment based on the number of full-time employees unless a different methodology is agreed upon between the Department of Administrative Services and the Judicial Department. Legislative Fiscal is working out a fiscal impact statement based on taking the law library out with the amendment because that really significantly changes the fiscal and may reduce it to minimal or no. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have three people that would like to speak to this bill, it seems. Is that correct?
That's right.
And I'm just going to ask them all to come up at the same time. One panel, Joe McKeever, Keith Adams, and Joe Stephan. Is that right?
Stephan.
Okay. You can choose as you wish who goes first.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Adams. I'm the business manager for the State Library. I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 577. Jim Chepke, our state librarian, was not able to be here to testify today, but I have submitted his testimony for the record. With me today is Joe McKeever, our Assistant Attorney General who works with our agency, and Joe Stephens, the state law librarian. Mr. McKeever is here today to explain to you why we need to amend the law dealing with the state library assessment on state agencies so that it conforms to our practice in the past decade.
Thank you, Chairman Shields, members of the committee. I am legal counsel to, and have been for quite a while, to the Oregon State Library. This bill is intended to establish and actually affirm a formula that has been used since 1995 in allocating costs among state agencies for state library services. The formula, as I think you've already understand, is based on an assessment of one-third of the agency's one-third of the assessment will be based on the amount the agency uses library services, and the other two-thirds will be based on the agency's full-time equivalent. The library staff, and I think perhaps some legislators, have been operating on the assumption that this was the formula that was allowed under the law, and they've been, I think, applying that formula since about 1995. This bill will establish that formula into law. That's what the bill's designed to do. And the Dash 2 amendment clarifies that the change would only apply to the state library. The law library would continue to employ the same assessment they've been using, which is based solely on full-time equivalent employees within each agency.
Questions of this witness? Anybody else want to testify here?
Well, I'm just here in support of the amendment. What it does really is just codify what we have done all along so that there's a kind of consonance between what's going on in the two cases. The bill as originally written made a change for us, and it was not a change that we thought was needed or that would do anything for us. We prefer to maintain the status quo here.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, yes. There is one other thing I could add. I heard some mention about fiscal impact. I may be missing something, but I wouldn't think this would have any fiscal impact because it's just an issue of how the assessment is going to be allocated among state agencies. There's no increase in the amount that's going to be spent.
Thank you. Senator Starr, you're a co-sponsor in this bill. Do you have any comments?
The faster we can end the hearing, the quicker we can move the bill, I think.
Fly or die.
Anything else? The hearing's closed. The work session is open. Senator Starr?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 577.
Senator Starr moves the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 577. Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 577 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 577 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I wanted Judith on the record with her rationale relative to the fiscal, just for the record. you made a comment to me that I find very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Yes, it would be my understanding that the fiscal impact would be minimal or no fiscal with the amendment, and I believe the gentleman's comment is right, and that is just changing the assessment method would not cause a fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other comments or any other discussion? Okay, you have before you Senate Bill 577. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it is so ordered, and I'm sure Senator Starr wants to carry the bill.
Certainly.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate it. That brings us down to, holy cow, I've lost my 589. Things get buried in this pile of rubble around here. Senate Bill 589, would you like to give us a backgrounder?
Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Senate Bill 589, we've heard once before, this is the measure that requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to approve training programs for persons employed by off-premises sales licensees. It provides that the licensee may require an employee to complete a training program if the licensee reimburses the employee for fees charged by the program. It provides that it is unlawful employment practice for a licensee to just discharge, demote, suspend, or otherwise discriminate against an employee for making a sale to a minor if the employee has not, in fact, completed such a training program. We have a no revenue impact statement. You will see that you already have a fiscal statement issued. We do have a request from LFO that this gets our subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and Mr. Tom Hughes from LFO is here to explain the chair's previous question, and that is why this particular measure had
2 years ago didn't have any. Now it has all of this. Can you come and explain why? Make it a good one, would you? I mean, it just didn't occur to me why there should be one now when there wasn't 2 years ago.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name's Tom Hughes. I'm from the Legislative Fiscal Office. And I got a heads up several days ago that a question came up as to why the bill, a similar bill that was dealt with in the 2001 session, is House Bill 3740, almost identical bill, how it to help explain why Senate Bill 589 now has a fiscal from the Liquor Control Commission. And I did some research and I made some phone calls and I communicated my findings to the committee administrator earlier today, and basically I had three or four points that I just wanted to quickly go over with you. Both Senate Bill 589 and the former bill require a review of the clerk training program under OLCC's Responsible Vendor Program. And the Responsible Vendor Program was enacted in 1999. At the time of House Bill 3740, OLCC was still in the early stages of assessing the workload that would occur under the Responsible Vendor Program. And now, at the time of Senate Bill 589, OLCC has better ability to assess workload requirements. The second point, I looked at the governor's recommended budget and noticed that between 01-03 and 03-05, there was a reduction of 14.5 FTE by the fifth special session in December 02. And 11 of that 14.5 FTE came from OLCC's regulatory division, which is responsible for the Responsible Vendor Program. Point three, I asked OLCC how many off-premises sales licensees they had at the time of the original bill in 01. That number was 3,579. And the latest number in December 04 was 3,732, or 153 more off-premise sales licensees, it's about a little over a 4% increase. I guess the other point was that the fiscal from Boley would require general fund for the position that they would request that would handle enforcement of unfair labor practices that would come up under this bill. And there'd be an impact to the general fund from the distributions that OLCC makes to this, not only the state general fund, but to local governments. So, in a nutshell, that's what I found.
Senator Herder.
Yes, sir. I tell you, there are times in this building that it defies all common sense. The Responsible Vendor Program simply was put together, as my understanding, so that if an employee inadvertently, through mistake, sells to a minor and they have been through a program helping them learn to identify either underage or if a person is drinking, whatever, helps them identify, they are not discharged or have a penalty on the first time. And that's it. Now, are you saying that according to the Bureau of Labor and Industries that if the employee has not been through the program and you discharge him, that that is an unfair labor practice? The bill directs it would be unlawful employment practice for an employer to discharge, demote, suspend, or otherwise discriminate against an employee for making a sale of alcohol to a minor if the employee had not completed a training program. What I can't understand while you're looking that up is that you already have the Responsible Vendor Program. So because it's going to be, what did you say, 150 thereabout off-premise establishments, now you have to have all these people when the program's been going for a long time. Why aren't the people that are now involved, and they don't have as many people in the Responsible Vendor Program as they estimated they would have. So consequently, you have a program, you don't have as many people in it, so now you're going to have a few more people in it, and now you have to hire more people. You're going to have to go back and explain that to me, because I do not understand that.
Chair Shields, Senator Berger, this is the information I received from Boley. I'm not able to find in my notes any specific answer to that question. One of the points I gave earlier was that there'd be 153, or there are 153 additional off-sales licensees. I just wanted to clarify
There must be a misprint in this, because I think what would make sense if it said it was an unlawful employment practice to demote and yada yada, mm-hmm. if the employee had completed the training program, because that's what the bill is talking about. If the employee has completed the program. Huh. And they're saying they'd need two more representatives in the civil rights issue.
I'm going to ask Mark Zoltan if he wouldn't come up here. That's why he gets to sit in the back of the room. He gets paid the big bucks that he gets paid, right? Is that right, Mark? Is that it? Half right? I see. That's why you get to sit in the back room. Do you want to respond to this? I mean, you happen to have something to do with Boley, I think, don't you?
For the record, I'm Mark Zoltan. I'm the Legislative Affairs Director of the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Chair Shields, I'll do my best. I have our fiscal impact statement that was filled out by our fiscal officer, who's not here today. Just to clarify, I believe we said it would force us to have 0.45, a little less than half an FTE in the 0507 biennium as a result of additional unlawful employment claims, and a 0.60 of an FTE in the 07 2009 biennium. Based on our analysis of what this law would do, it would create a new unlawful employment practice that doesn't exist right now, and therefore would have an impact on our workload. And as the gentleman from LFO explained, unfortunately, that impact would be on the general fund, and that is what we've outlined here in the fiscal. And that's based on our best estimate of how many of these cases might arise. We put that number about 80. It's a guesstimate. We have some good basis for the number from the United Food and Commercial Workers, who know how many union members they have who do this kind of work and therefore have some sense and who are supportive of the bill, of how many of their members might be impacted. But at least half or more than half of folks who sell alcohol in this manner might be affected are non-union employees, and I don't have a good number on that. So it is an estimate that we would have 80 cases a year.
Mr. Chair, Mark, look at how that reads, because I believe that it doesn't make a new program. I think today I'm working in a liquor store. A person comes in. I've had no training at all. Person comes in and I sell to a minor. I believe today I can be discharged.
I'm not familiar with the laws that.
So I think this is a misprint. I think what it should have said, now maybe I'm wrong, that if the employee had completed the training program, in other words, if they were part of the responsible vendor program, it doesn't make sense the other way to me. The responsible vendor program is an attempt to help the worker not be discharged the first time they've made a mistake. And good, here comes John. Maybe he can help clarify this.
Help!
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. John Stubenval, Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, you're absolutely correct. The Responsible Vendor Program exists today in statute. However, Senate Bill 589 does a little thing with the existing program. So the representative from Boley is absolutely correct in that Senate Bill 589 would create a new piece in statute about workplace employment. In other words, today the responsible vendor program protects the liquor license holder from losing that liquor license should an employee sell alcohol to a minor. There's nothing in current statute today that protects the employee who actually sells the alcohol to the minor.
Well, John, if I go through the training, I don't get fired the first time. Isn't that true, or am I mistaken?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I'm afraid today there is no such piece in statute.
Then what is
that's what the bill would do?
For going, all the motivation comes from the employer side.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, today the Responsible Vendor Program is designed to protect the employer, the liquor license holder, from losing that liquor license should an employee sell alcohol to a minor. That's what the program is designed to do today. Today, there are no direct employee benefits in the program. That's really what the proposed legislation would do.
Well, I stand corrected. I thought the employee, if he went through he or she went through the Responsible Vendor Program training, had some protection if they inadvertently made a mistake. Only the vendor doesn't lose his license. Okay.
I have gone from thinking we had a good bill here that we wanted to get through, and then we stumbled over the fiscal issue, to a bill where you guys get a couple positions and you get 4,500ths of one and 60 hundredths of one later, and now I wonder what we're doing with this bill in front of us at all. What's the deal here? Anybody want to help me out? I mean, passing this to Ways and Means is half the time the kiss of death on anything, and that's where you really want us to go, huh?
I guess the problem, Mr. Chair, is that if you have a good idea and a good program and you're trying to help people, but it costs so much money, that is truly a shame. I think the Responsible Vendor Program is an excellent program, and I wish that they had more people in it. Then I also was under the impression that there was some little benefit to the employee as well as the employer.
Sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve Lanning with the Oregon AFL-CIO. We brought this bill to you with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 555 that represent grocery clerks. This is our second attempt to get this bill passed. It passed unanimously in the House two sessions ago. What we're seeking from this bill, and it turns out now there are a number of other bills in the building as well that do similar things or different things, but do come to the same, you know, go in the right direction, is we're trying to find some kind of protection for grocery clerks, some kind of training that's required for grocery clerks, because ultimately we want to keep alcohol out of the hands of minors. And right now, as you know, there's no protection for a clerk when they inadvertently make an error. They lose their job. A lot of them do. And we don't think it's fair, so we're trying to come up with something that's not a huge mandate, that's not going to really impair business, but yet is going to move in the right direction to get protection for clerks.
Senator Jones.
Why not a bill that says that every employee shall have an opportunity to participate in a training program, and if they do that and they hold their little certificate, that they cannot be fired on the first offense, boom, end of problem.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, our original attempt a couple sessions ago was a bill that said you got to train your clerks. That's what our bill. That was a mandate, and so we worked out an amended bill with then Representative Witt, who chaired House Commerce, and he came up with this bill that passed unanimously in the House. And so we thought, well, that's a good place to start again this whole process. And so that's where we came up. We're willing to look at different kinds of things because there's a lot of grocery clerks that have been doing this for a long time that get caught up under the huge pressure to get everybody through their line and end up making an inadvertent error and lose their jobs. So we're willing to look at all kinds of things. Thanks.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lanning, what are the other bills that are out there? I mean, have you looked at those, and do you see any way to get out of this fix that we're in with some of those other bills?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, there's one bill that decriminalizes, or there's going to be amendments to one that decriminalizes the first offense if you inadvertently make an error. Right now, you not only lose your job, it's a misdemeanor, and there are fines. And so there's one bill that has an amendment, so if you inadvertently make alcohol available or sell it to a minor, that it would be a violation. The fine would go up slightly, but it would be a violation, and that's a step in the right direction, we think, for grocery clerks. So they not only don't lose their job, they don't have a misdemeanor necessarily. So making it a violation, decriminalizing it if you inadvertently make an error. There's another bill that's going to be out in a day or two on the House side that addresses the problem in a little slightly different way as far as training goes. So new licensees would have to provide training to their employees, and the bill also deals with if your employees or inadvertently sell to a minor, then from now on you've got to train your employees. So it's not an absolute mandate, but it starts going down the right path. So we're open to whatever works. There's also a couple of bad bills that we're not interested in
right now. I'm sure. It sounds like there's pieces of bills that might help us here, Mr. Chair. I think my goal is to help these grocery clerks not get caught in this situation. I think that's
your goal, my goal. Too. Yeah. I think that's everybody's goal.
I mean, the Responsible Vendor Program is good. I think the grocery clerks should be trained. And I don't think they should be fired if they inadvertently make one mistake. Mm-hmm. I just think that's not right.
The Senate President's office is pretty paranoid about fiscals.
Yeah, well, and this one.
Well, there was a time when this wouldn't have been such a big deal.
Yeah.
I mean, the way the legislature has gone, smaller and smaller amounts of money become bigger and bigger deals. What I wanted was something that could go to the floor and get passed and get the job done. I still feel like I'm in a quandary as to whether I want to just hold this bill here and see what else comes along that can be worked in with it, or to send it to Ways and Means where I don't know what will happen to it. And so I guess I'm asking for some direction. Mr. Lanning.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if I'm correct, but I think I might be. This might be the one vehicle on the Senate side that could be amended to, if we can get folks to agree, what would be a good way to go. There's a number of bills on the House side that may or may not come over here, but for the Senate side, if I want to maybe work with a couple of folks and come up with some amendments that work for everybody and that aren't a big mandate and don't have a big fiscal, maybe this could be the vehicle to amend.
So would you like us to hang on to this here, and could you do that?
Yes.
Would you want to do that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would like to do that, and I think the United Food and Commercial Workers would like to do that.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a better idea for us to keep it instead of sending it to Ways and Means where we can't get it back, and if Mr. Lanning's willing to work with us.
And can you talk to some of the other players that were around here today? Especially, who was the gentleman who's, I think, left now from the fiscal?
Oh, Tom Hughes from the fiscal, but yeah.
Okay. Or enlist Judith's support. We got to deal with those folks somehow.
Okay, I will, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your interest.
Because I do not want this to go away, okay?
No, and Mr. Chair, I was looking at the testimony from the 1st of March that we had on this. And I don't support Mr. Linden's position that this bill would erode the trend of zero tolerance approach to sales to minors.
No, I wasn't convinced by the original opponents of the bill. This has just gotten in a quagmire that I want to get it out of. Okay?
Okay, thank you. Yes.
With that, I'm going to close the hearing on that was Senate Bill 589, and we've got one left.
Yep.
Is that right?
Yes.
Senate Bill 807. Now we've already
not heard again.
Heard? We haven't heard this at all yet.
No. Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, let's hear it then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 807 requires state agencies to provide a person with software and templates necessary to comply with an agency's requirement that a record or signature be created, generated, sent, communicated, received, stored, or otherwise processed or used by the person through electronic means or in an electronic form. We have received a no fiscal, no revenue impact on this measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is this true? We only have one person signed up on this? Catherine and...
I see Georgia's shadow, so...
You're Georgia's shadow.
Yeah, so I'm kind of...
All right, I'll let Catherine go first, if that's okay with you, sir.
That's fine with me.
Thank you. Chair Shields and members of the committee, my name is Catherine Weber. I'm a technology analyst with DAS, the Department of Human Services, and we're here today to provide some background or context to this bill. The first thing is that at this point in time, we are unaware of any state agency that is actually requiring third parties, or as the bill refers to, persons outside of state government to do transactions electronically. In fact, there's the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act, which was passed in 2001, and it's called UEDA, and it specifically requires parties to transactions to mutually agree that they're going to do business electronically. The other issue is that right now business models as well as technology models are evolving, and there are some things coming along that we would like to have an opportunity to explore. The feds, who are the, quote, big gorillas in the field of electronic transactions and specifically around electronic and digital signatures, have some models that they're rolling out that the state agencies are taking a look at. Basically, what we're doing is respectfully suggesting that you may want to delay this bill until next session when we have, when the technology has matured, the business models have matured, and we can make a better guesstimate of what the cost or fiscal impact might be in the future.
So you're suggesting that this bill doesn't go anywhere right now?
Yes, Chair.
Do you want his comments on the record, too?
If we could.
Okay. Senator George.
Catherine, when we talked, just before I headed down for committee.
Yes, Senator.
We talked about the idea that you appreciated the bill putting the push on.
Yes.
Which, and you, you and Representative, Jim Thompson have talked since that time. If you could bring us up to speed, because we had just, before we, you know, got the chance to meet you, had just talked with an agency that we had concern about and found out that their brand new program that DAS has helped them to develop does, in fact, allow for all the exchanges that we were concerned about very simply online. So they are moving that way.
And are you specifically referring to the Secretary of State? Because there is, and one of the things we've talked about in the meantime is that there is a bill, Senate Bill 160, which deals with setting up campaign and finance reporting. And my understanding, and actually in the text of the bill, it requires it to be provided free of charge. And I think that addresses some of the concerns that you had, Senator.
Actually, we're referring to the Board of Aeronautics new program as being a good example of a direction that we should set as a goal.
Just for the record, do you want to identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm Jim Thompson from Senator George's office. The origin of this bill came both as some constituent complaints we received in our office and also looking to the future in terms of where we're going with electronic media worldwide as well as in the state of Oregon. We had some specific complaints from people who had run for office concerning the Secretary of State's program for reporting campaign expenditures and campaign activities and the cost they had to incur to get on board with that program. Which certainly, you know, is a valid point. But then in looking ahead, we're looking at the agricultural pesticide reporting legislation going through that will eventually be implemented, and that's going to be another big reporting situation for a lot of people in the field of agriculture with numerous reports on a regular basis. And so we started. That's when we started asking questions, and we uncovered the Board of Aeronautics, which has actually been delayed on getting their system up and running. It was supposed to be up in March.
Aeronautics couldn't get it off the ground.
Yeah, you said that. I didn't. Yeah,
I'm sorry.
But yeah. Anyway, they have a program that they've been implementing for some time, which will require registration of airplanes by location. You move your privately owned plane from McMinnville to Salem, you have to register the fact that you moved it and it's now based in Salem. Well, they've done what we believe to be the right thing, and they're going online with it. You'll call up the Aeronautics Board website, fill out the form indicating your location move, pay your fee electronically. There's always a fee attached to it, but at least you can pay it electronically.
Who needs a signature when you charge money?
The deal is done. So the purpose of our legislation was twofold, and one was to try to get us out of some situations that we're nudging into and simplify things somewhat. The other is to look forward and set a tone for what state government can and will do in the future. There's no doubt about the situation. We're going more and more digital, electronic all the time, and I can foresee a time when a great deal of reporting is to be done. If we simply cost shift these programs by allowing or forcing taxpayers to buy into software to file their legislative required reports, we're just going to have a whole lot of really unhappy people. And maybe now is the time to be looking at that and saying, as a policy, we don't want to go that way. We just became aware an hour before this this particular hearing of what DAS is doing, and I commend them for doing that. And I have no specific objections to delaying this to another session. I think I would appreciate some sort of positive position from this committee that that is, in fact, something that should be looked at and will be looked at, so we can nudge the state toward equitable electronic filing of forms, et cetera. But they might not do it if there isn't a hammer. That's the thing about people, not the government.
Senator George, this is your bill. What would you like to do with regard to that?
Well, I would hate to do this after what we've been doing today, but I'd love to put a delay on this. Let us take a look at what Catherine has reassured us, that they're moving in this direction. And I shared with her last session my bill called the Tax Me More Fund. Treasury came in and says, we'll do that, what you want, and they have done that. And all I cared about, I told them, was making sure that we had a mechanism for people to donate money. Here, if we have a commitment to move forward with addressing the issue that if we require this to occur, that we will, in fact, either make it totally user-friendly, as Jim has described with aviation, or provide a mechanism, or, for example, like with attorneys transmitting documents and stuff like that, you know, a reasonable fee that, you know, would fit into a scenario. That's all we want, is to make sure we're headed progressively in that kind of direction.
Well, that's on the record now, sir.
Okay.
Anybody see a problem with that?
No.
So we're just going to kind of... Yes.
Yeah. May I just clarify that I haven't promised, first of all, I don't have the authority to do it, that in no circumstances would the state ever charge a fee related to obtaining a digital signature or an electronic signature, but the state will make every effort possible to make sure that the interfaces and the usage is as easy and as inexpensive as possible, and that the debate about whether any fee could be charged, for example, if we wanted to charge Medicaid applicants a fee for a digital signature, that not happen. But on the other end of the spectrum, there may be some opportunities or challenges around providing digital signatures for all the attorneys in the state, and that the debate at 2 years down the road may be how and when fees could be charged. Is that fair?
Don't use nonverbal language. We've got microphones here. Senator George, what did you just say?
I said, yes, I'm agreeable to that, and you know me, I have a long memory, so I'll remember what promises were made, and we'll look forward to a progressive report, just as we had with aviation today.
All right. Okay. Senator Verge,
Chair, I just want to make a comment, and I've made it before, probably in this committee, but I just want to make a comment that I am always opposed to anyone being charged less because they file it electronically. I don't. If you want to charge fees, then that, and to run the department, but I do not approve of charging less to people who, because they have a computer, go to the front of the line. We have a lot of older people in my district, right, who do not use the computer.
Yeah, it is kind of elitist in some senses, isn't it?
Mr. Chairman, I think the issue here is that it's not charging less. It's the opening, there is no other avenue. In the case of what we have with the Secretary of State's office, you are really kind of slammed
into
it.
Well, that's where we're going to leave it, and I'm going to close the hearing on that. But before we close our committee for today, I think Senator Walker wanted a chance to record her vote on Senate Bill 856. Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
To suspend the rules.
So we need unanimous consent to suspend the rules. Is that okay? Okay, we've got unanimous consent. Since there was no disagreement, can you call that roll of one real quick?
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Okay, so Senator Walker is recorded as an aye on Senate Bill 856. Is there any other business before the committee? Remember that Thursdays may get a little bit long, and I want to tell you just real quick, I've got all five of you here. Safe and Liberty Northwest are in some conversations with one another. Can you believe that?
Good.
Yes.
With Corey Streisinger kind of working as a referee. Okay? They have actually picked next Thursday as a continuation of their time of talking. So we're going to have all the other bills that are on the agenda for Thursday going up to 4:30. And at 4:30, they're going to come in and report the latest on their conversations.
For Thursday. Okay.
And these are conversations on a particular issue, or
these are conversations on
disclosure, on the public records.
It has to do with They've been talking a little bit about public records, but group contracts.
Mm-hmm.
The assigned risk pool, the idea of the insurer of last resort, all of that kind of. Corey and I talked, and she said the first day they used just to call one another names, and once they got that taken care of, the next two or three sessions have been very productive.
Yeah, Tyrus, and you.
And Mr. Chair, I'd like to report that Mr. Christavy and I met this afternoon. They proposed some amendments to my Senate Bill 752, which is the budget, reporting their budget to the legislature. And I'm going to review those. I think we're going to come to agreement on that as well. As you know, I will not be here on Thursday because I'll be with the Judiciary Committee in Pendleton.
Some of us get to go play cowpoke. I mean, what can I say? But anyway, the rest of us will have an interesting time on Thursday, and I just wanted to let you know that. You can get a little playback of that session at 4:30 if you want to. Okay? With that, the committee's adjourned. Thank you for your time.